Okay, so I am here with Ross McElwee, who is most recently the director of Photographic Memory. Ross, it's a pleasure to have you. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Yes, and I'm sorry I didn't wear my Opus shirt. I couldn't find one. I don't think they even make them anymore. I was expecting you to come in and film me or something.
Well, that could be arranged. I've got a little camera right here.
Oh, I see. Well, I've got mine here. Anyway, so I know you wrote an essay on Walker Percy's The Last Gentleman, which is very interesting because I've seen your films, and they really make me think of what Percy said about certification in The Moviegoer, which, of course, is taken from Martin Heidegger's notion of Alltaglichkeit, everydayness and being in time. You know, this idea where we go about our lives, we're always sort of reflecting on what the meaning of this is, and he said that it was essential. So I'm wondering, you know, how can the video medium, which you have actually gravitated to for the first time with this film, and social media and our present landscape take into account this notion of everydayness? I mean, this film almost seems to be an argument for and against it. So what of this?
That's a question. That's an essay.
Well, we do essay questions and answers here. Sort of similar to your films, I think.
It is. It's actually perfectly complements my whole way of making films because it's a very complex thing that you're asking me. And to me, filming the everyday, filming little moments from everyday life, it's totally essential to understanding what the life as a whole is about. And I think it's somehow not the recording of any specific moment of life that leads to a richer understanding or a deeper presentation of the meaning of that particular life, but it's the accretion of all of those things and the overlapping, the patterns, the resonances of daily moments filmed that resonate with things that you've already seen before. And I find, as I get older, as I film, you know, my friends and my family, that I see patterns and layers of meaning that would not have been there if I had just filmed one time. So I think it's partially that curiosity about the moment and being in the present, and that's very, very important in my filmmaking. And yet now there's also a kind of layering that seems to be happening de facto, which is because I've been filming for a long, long time, that I'm led to putting together combinations of shots and scenes and moments that span decades. And I have the luxury of doing that now because I'm getting older.
Yeah.
One of the few benefits of getting older.
And the films have gotten shorter, however.
Yeah, well, that's partially because people don't have the patience to sit through 2.5-hour films anymore.
I do.
Well, you're not a typical viewer, that's for sure.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing, aside from the fact that this is shot on video, there are a number of surprises about this film, aesthetically speaking, where it just does not seem like a Ross McElwee film. I mean, we have, of course, the sort of photos with the music, and I was like, am I watching a Ken Burns movie, or am I watching a McElwee movie?
Right.
Or even the fact that you gravitate more towards the past instead of the present.
Yes.
If you are altering your voice to fit the needs of what is required today, is it truly a genuine McElwee movie?
No, well, I'm not altering the voice because of marketing. There's no way that I'm doing that. But I think it really is a matter of becoming older. And for me, for having kids, or at least a son who's a different generation, starting to wonder, what is this tension that I feel with my son, and why does it seem so extreme? And that led me to go back to my own past. And I think in doing so, I did find, I wasn't shooting film back then, I don't have images to get moving images to call upon to represent what I was going on, what was happening at that point in my life. But I do have still photographs. And so, yes, there's still photographs in my film. And it is the first time I've used them this extensively. You're absolutely right about that. And it's the first time I've used stretches of music the way that I have in this film. Music has been in all of my films, but it's diegetic. It comes out of the filming itself, the filming environment.
But the music comes before the voice, whereas in the previous films, the voice has kind of ushered in the music.
Yes, that's true. Although I do, yes, you're right. And that's a different way of using music. And but I think I felt that these were raw materials that I had available, which represented what my life was like at that time, and therefore I had to draw on them. And it did make me make a different kind of film. Of course, the other large difference was that I'm much older now, and so there's much more to look back on. And so in that way, it does become more, quote, historical, unquote. You know?
Much more to look back on. What about looking forward? I mean, the thing that I was shocked watching this movie because I was expecting like the cross-country quest of some kind, but no, it really is going backwards towards life towards events that are half a lifetime ago. I mean, why should they define who you are in the present? They certainly haven't in other films you've made.
No, and I think it may be a one-time departure but I feel I've now earned the right to make whatever film I want to make, and that was the film I wanted to make. And I think it's mainly because of what I say in the beginning of the film, is that I'm a little stymied by my relationship to my son, and I'm sort of confused by the directions he's going in, and those directions are somewhat representative of his entire generation. But I'm also, you know, smart enough to realize that my father had the same questions about me. I didn't go to medical school.
Yeah.
Why? You know, that's puzzling. Why would you not want to do something that would guarantee you a comfortable and fulfilling life? No, I want to become a filmmaker. What is that all about? He must have, you know, really wondered about those things. So.
But the difference between you and your father and Adrian and you is that we have this image you have throughout your films of your father showing how to suture up something and your brother going ahead and participating, which you've used that repeatedly.
Yes.
In this, it's almost like you're the hired cameraman for Adrian's movies. It's not necessarily like the passing of a legacy that Adrian rejects, although Adrian also adopts the filmmaking guy. So, I mean, is there really a parallel here?
Well, not a precise parallel, but, you know, there's some irony, too, in that I become Adrian's cameraman at the end of the film, and I think that's meant to be somewhat humorous.
Yeah.
People understand that, and I'm doing documentaries and determined to do fiction, and, you know, not only that, but I become his cinematographer. It's quickly, clearly a departure for me to go in some of the directions I've gone in this film, but I think it's very healthy. But why not try something you haven't tried before, and I've done it, and, you know, whether I'll do something similar again remains to be seen.
Going back to adjusting to recent developments of the last 5 or 6 years, smartphones, social media, and so forth, I mean, one of our first images of Adrian, he is plugged into his laptop, quite literally. He has the laptop in front of him, he has the headphones, he has this massive cafe drink with a bright blue straw, and you were trying to say, I need your full attention, and he refuses this. And this, to my mind, was, I mean, because I saw your film twice. The first time, I was horrified by this. The second time, I actually came to sympathize with Adrian a little bit more.
Right.
But I actually initially thought, oh, my God, he's a spoiled brat. Here he is going ahead, and the great Ross McElwee is being dissed by his own son. So, you know.
But that's his job as a son, is to diss his dad.
Yeah, but diss in that sort of way, not have a meaningful conversation with you. I mean, because it seems that you clearly establish, especially when you drag out all of your own notebooks and all of your own photos.
Right.
I mean, there's meticulous ideas that you've set down in your youth, and he's sort of like frivolously typing away on his.
Oh, but see, my father thought I was frivolously scribbling away in my notebooks.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like so judgmental of fathers to be that way about their sons.
Or viewers to be that way about patriarchal relationships.
And the other thing you can say is, well, yeah, he's busy texting and listening to some conversation at the same time. He's multitasking and he doesn't even hear me when I ask the question or acknowledge that he's heard me. But what am I doing? I've got a digital camera on my shoulder. Who am I to sort of criticize him for being wrapped up in his technology when I'm also wrapped up in my technology?
Well, you weren't in the camera shop, but I'm pretty sure you weren't hurling a beverage. I'm pretty certain.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, he had more distractions than you going
on. He's more ambidextrous than I am.
Ambidextrous. But, I mean, you know, you say that it's pretty much the same thing, but I would argue, given all the additional impediments that are in front of Adrian, that it's not. That your quest into France was a quest for, you know, the usual frivolities of falling into weird relationships. I mean, you have the image of your son next to his girlfriend, and there are two laptops there.
Right.
I mean, that's a fundamental difference that kind of disrupts the parallel. So what of this? Can you actually really adopt a parallel between your early life and Adrian's?
No, of course. It's never precisely the same from generation to generation.
Yeah.
We all know that. And I think the things that you point out visually were stunning to me when I actually saw them through the viewfinder, the two laptops opened at right angles to each other, you know, at a cafe table.
You didn't notice when you were filming, it was sort of like the rat in the hotel.
Well, I did notice when I was filming because I thought, oh, this is the image I'm looking for. I didn't tell them to do that, but the minute I saw it, I said, I'm going to film this because it just seems so appropriate. But I think it's unfair to be too critical of Adrian and his generation for so being so wrapped up in this technology, because it's available. And, you know, I was shooting 16 millimeter film because it was suddenly available in a portable sense. You could put these cameras on your shoulder and go into the world for the first time. That was the whole cinema verite revolution.
And,
you know, my dad didn't understand any of that. He thought it was crazy. And in fact, you know, at the very beginning, so did most funding agencies, public television, arts agencies. Nobody got it that this was going to be something significant, that you could take technology into the world and interact with it on its own terms, as opposed to bringing people into the studio and interviewing them, or recreating things the way Flaherty did, you know, as directing it as if it were a fiction film using, you know, people from real life. And in fact, it took a while for people to understand the possibilities of cinema verite. It is, you know, before I began making films. Those guys, Leacock and Basils and Pennybaker, they had to really fight to get their kinds of filmmaking seen and shown and produced. So it's always, there's always a learning curve for the rest of them.
Yeah. And I dig all those guys, but the one commonality throughout all that early cinema verite is that there is a concern for capturing the human as opposed to cutting reality up into sort of a stylistic melange that gets in the way of really grasping of life. I mean, you try to recreate that famous moonshot from Sherman's March in this film, but we see that we have all these buildings there and your monologue is there, but like the moon is more insignificant on video and it's populated by all these buildings and so forth. So, you know, I mean, clearly you're aware that this is either fading or this is in competition with the sort of YouTube confessional, YouTube star movement and so forth. I mean, where do you fit in? Is there a place for you, do you think?
In this, yeah, that's a good question. I think I'm not really trying to tailor my films for any particular generation or any particular venue. I didn't know where this film was going to end up. It was commissioned by French television, but aside from that, I had no idea where it would end up. And even that was an obscure presentation platform. It was a late-night experimental television series.
Yes.
And, you know, I was very happy to accept their commission to make this film. But I didn't know what kind of film it would be, and I didn't feel I could tailor it to sit to suit any particular category or any particular audience. And so, you know, there's a way in which perhaps I'm shooting myself in the foot by not really thinking more about where these films are destined, and is there a way I can make them more accessible to the younger generation who will then, you know, download it from their computers. And I can't think like that. I'm just, for whatever reason, I'm just driven to make a film because I want to make it on my own terms.
And well, I want to actually discuss this film in relation to Time Indefinite. I mean, you couldn't think of two more opposite movies. In Time Indefinite, it's very naked. I mean, literally and figuratively, you have that 72-second shot of the tumor. You have Marilyn...
You've even timed it. Remarkable.
Well, I actually got that from some other geek who had actually timed it. I probably should have, but I like the precision of that 72
seconds. Fact check.
I have to fact check. I'll go back afterwards. But also, what is really fascinating to me is that Marilyn Levine, who was willing to allow you to film her completely, your wife, in Time Indefinite, down to, you know, her pregnancy. I mean, the only shot we see of her in photographic memory is at the beginning where you do a pan and you see that she's cut off. And I was really curious about this because it seems to me that if you're talking about family dynamics, should you not include the entire family? I mean, why wasn't Marilyn involved with this film? I mean, are you guys married? There are all sorts of questions. This movie is all about disguise and hiding, whereas Time Indefinite is all about openness. And so I'm wondering why.
Well,
this.
You know, to be honest, I think as time went on, Marilyn became less and less enamored with the idea of being filmed. And I think...
You guys are still married?
No.
No.
No. I mean, there's, you know, that's how it ended up, not because of my filming, but I think... been divorced now for a year, and it's an incredibly painful experience. And it happened after this film was finished.
Really? Do you think the filmmaking led to the divorce at
no,
all?
Of course
or was
not. There were deeper problems. But I'm just I'm saying that I think as time went on, she appears less and less in my films. Yeah. In 6 o'clock News, she's only in 2 or 3 scenes, and in Bright Leaves, I think she's only in 1 shot for 5 seconds. And it's not because she was saying don't film, but I sensed she just, as she got older, she just wanted to sort of regain her privacy. And
yeah.
When you're younger, you don't really care as much. You just, anything can be filmed and you can do whatever you want to with it. And I think she became less enamored with that whole notion.
Do you share this sentiment of wanting to preserve your privacy now as you are older? Because that's the great, like I said, the great obverse here. I mean, it seems to me that if you're talking about a family that has problems, you should tackle every single area.
No, there's certain areas that I can't make films. I don't categorically make a film that includes every aspect of my family life or my personal life, but I just don't. You know, people do. It's been done. I'm just not that person. I can't do it.
Do you think that focusing exclusively on you and Adrian is really a truthful way of presenting this dynamic?
What do you mean by truthful? It's a definite portrait of our relationship, but it doesn't include everything that I could be talking about.
Yeah. So in 6 o'clock News, you include this meeting with Josh Kornbluth, who was asking you to direct a fiction film. And you say then, I've never directed a fiction film. Uh-huh. Well, have we just established at the end of the photographic memory, you finally have made a fiction film. This leads me to wonder, in light of the fact I went to the photographic memory website, and I see that Adrian is listed as actor and production assistant.
Right.
So, you know,
tongue in cheek a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. But it made me wonder, well, now that you have at least done a portion of a fiction film, is the entirety of photographic memory to some degree a fiction film in whole?
Well, then there's the whole question of what's the difference between a documentary and a fiction film anyway.
Yeah.
All documentaries manipulate reality, both through editing, shooting, and editorial decisions about what the films are about, to sort of give it a shape that one could say is a narrative shape, and that narrative by some extension could be thought of as being fictional, but it's not purely fictional. That's what's so intriguing to me about staying in this particular vein. I mean, I've been asked from the very beginning of my career, when are you going to make the big shift to fiction? When are you going to go to Hollywood? That's a pervasive question that I've heard 1,000 times. It's clear that I have, you know, some kind of gift for putting together a narrative that works and makes people want to see my work. Why not just shift it to fiction altogether? And I think, for me, there is a sense that there's a way in which this juxtaposition of fiction and reality creates something that's very unique and powerful, and that I've stumbled into it.
Yeah.
Never would have predicted this would be what I do for my life's work, but that it works for me. And for, you know, a small spectrum of the overall movie-going public out there, there's something that people seem to appreciate. So keep playing with it, keep developing it. And of course, the other thing that you've correctly identified that's shifting is that I'm getting older. There's more archival material to keep ratcheting back to. And what kinds of possibilities does that create for a shift in the kinds of films I make? I don't know the answer to this, but I'm finding out film by film.
Do you think that this middle ground between what fiction is and what truth is sort of the way to seek what I was suggesting at the onset, which was, you know, Heidegger's everydayness, that is really now the tension in early 21st century life, and may in fact even determine what the future of film and video and expression through the visual arts is.
Well, it's interesting that you say fiction versus truth,
yes,
as opposed to fiction versus nonfiction.
Yes, well, I'm allowing a little bit of liberty here with the terms.
But it's an interesting way of stating it.
Yeah.
And it does, you know, the whole notion of cinema verite representing truth, I mean, everybody realized that was just a crock. No film can possibly encompass the entirety of whatever the reality is that it's dealing with. It's like Tolstoy, you know, wrote that no novel can possibly communicate all the facts that could be written about a particular character. It's
just with the exception of Andy Warhol's Empire, perhaps.
Well, even that, though, you know, it's just Empire. Why didn't it go on for another day?
Yeah.
You know, you could always ask that question. Yeah. There was another day in which the Empire was there, and, you know, he didn't film it. Why? You know, it's a good question. I think, but I do think, you know, reality television is a phenomenon that's obviously here to stay to some degree, and it keeps being shifted and repackaged, but it's clear that since it came on the scene, people are interested in this juxtaposition of manipulative structuring via setting up a sort of faux contest in which people are, but the people are from real life,
yeah.
but they're also performers, and they've also been called from 1,000 auditions, 1,000 people auditioning to become the 6 or 7 people who are in competition in, you know, Survivor or whatever the show is. That there's a kind of fascination with that, that these are real people, they're not actors, and yet they are actors, and what does that mean, you know?
Yeah.
Charlene Swansea is this wonderful presence in many of my films. Not in this film. She'll be in another film. She's been in past films.
Why not this one?
Well, because she didn't speak French.
Yeah, but you could have gone to her right before going off to France. I mean, you know, she's sort of your muse. She's your guide. I mean, I read one interview where you said, I will do anything that Charlene tells me to do.
Right. I just couldn't figure out. I mean, it's not like I was struggling to find a way to put her into this film, but it seemed slightly irrelevant for her to be a part of this. So of course, if she had come into it, she would have made it relevant. She has a way of doing that. But
wait, let me get this straight. Ross McElwee going ahead and complaining about irrelevance, when in fact the relevance is in the seeming irrelevance.
Right. Well, you're totally right about that. You caught me in that. Transgressing against.
I'm literally stunned.
Yeah, I know. Well, so am I. I can't believe that sentence came out of my mouth.
Yeah.
I couldn't think of I could not make. It's not like I was weighing a decision about whether or not to go down south and film Charlene. It's just that logistically, I seemed to have the material I needed to make the film I wanted to make by just filming around the house with Adrian, and that's what I did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can always put in another chapter. You can always make something else work. I didn't do it for whatever reason.
Or perhaps you wanted to focus exclusively on the home dynamic versus the dynamic in France. And it was a compartmentalization of environment. Was that kind of one of the appeals here?
I think so. But, you know, the home environment, only a sliver of the home environment, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
I put restrictions on what I'd film.
Yeah. But on the other hand, there are enough clues that allow us to want to know more. I mean, obviously, I'm prying a little bit, and I almost feel a little bit bad about this. On the other hand, you've made the film, like, the detail about, like, don't destroy this dish because your mother is going to complain. And I then started to wonder, well, is there some sort of significance to the dish? Is there some sort of, you know, like, the fact that you were very adamant in that particular moment and you felt the need to include it in the film made me look for sort of significance there. On the other hand, you know,
well, no,
if it's irrelevant, we're talking about relevance versus irrelevant, well, that could be argued both ways.
Well, you know, I certainly didn't calculate to say that at that particular moment. It just sort of came out because I did see he was sort of tossing this thing around and he could easily have broken it if he weren't careful. And it's, you know, I've said that kind of thing to him 100 times.
Yeah.
So it just came out and it didn't really have any particular significance, but it does point to, you know, what you're talking about, there is a significant absence in the film, and the absence is Adrian's mother.
Well, to sort of tie this into what you were saying earlier about reality TV, do you think that the future of documentary filmmaking might in fact be informed more by the relationship between the audience trying to detect how true the details are, a la a film like Catfish, as opposed to, or that might be the way to kind of seduce them, so to speak, into finding the marvel of the everyday, of that long take of the moon and so forth?
Well, I guess I have this inherent faith that if you film the everyday and then contextualize it properly, that there'll always be a place for it in nonfiction and documentary film. And I have to believe that. That's not really going to change, despite all the shifts that are going on around us on the internet and YouTube and Facebook, that there's still a place for carefully honed image making, and that includes very long shots and just thinking about the everyday and looking at it a little more intensely. That I still believe in.
But you do have one line of photographic memory where you say, like, you know, look at the details, and I'm paraphrasing, but you will look at the details and you'll find that there's more there. And this is, as I had intimated in earlier, I had mentioned the rat in Bright Leaves at the motel that you're filming, and there's this rat in the distance, and then you say, oh, well, maybe I should probably upgrade my accommodations next time. So this has been a long-standing concern, and I don't think it's necessarily incompatible with the faster editing that's required, with the need to grab attention, the need to make shorter films. I mean, you know, open up your eyes as a filmmaker or as just a human, and you always have details to find and to locate and to marvel at.
Right, and sometimes you manage to capture those details, not even aware that you captured them. And that's the perfect example. But no, I think That's very true, and that's the heart and soul of nonfiction documentary filmmaking.
Steve M., there's this wonderful moment where the news is essentially going and sensationalizing his life. You just talk to him, and we find out more through everyday conversation than any of the sort of sensationalized, you know, dramatic music and so forth, which has gotten much worse in recent years.
That's for
sure. The news column didn't even exist back then. Do you think that sitting down and having conversations or trying to have conversations, that is still going to be able, that we'll be able to get at the truth of human existence through that mode? Or are we going to have to go ahead and convince people like Adrian, who are plugged in, to have these conversations? I mean, you know, if you can't have a conversation with your own son, how can we have a conversation with a great expanse of humanity to understand it more?
Oh, but I think it's, in many ways, much easier to have conversations with people you don't know well than with your own son, of course. And so, with Steve M., this example that you cite, the kind of filmmaking that I've always done my life, and I'm certainly not the only one, but it requires an investment of time.
Yeah.
A huge investment of time and getting to know people and their world. And it means actually logistically committing to staying in one place for a long time. And in this culture, sitting tight in one place is something we don't do very much anymore. As filmmakers, you kind of have to get a certain kind of footage. Not everybody wants that kind of footage. I still think it's important. So I actually had to spend, you know, 2 weeks with Steve M.
Yeah.
Before I could really talk to him. And it's not to say what the news reporters did was inaccurate or wrong. They just are doing something totally different than what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I was interested in what was really going on in his life after this horrible tragedy, the murder of his wife had occurred.
Yeah.
This Korean immigrant who came to the United States, did quite well for himself, and then lost his wife in a robbery. And he had children to raise, and he was living in Arkansas, of all places. And how is he dealing with this? And it took 2 weeks of just seeing him every day, showing up at his house, spending some time with him, going to work with him, meeting his family, having tea, endless times before he, and it's not like he was resisting talking to me, I just think he was, and same for true was true for me, didn't quite know what I was doing there.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
I just sensed there might be another story to tell, and the story was there, and I found it after, you know, a couple of weeks.
I also wanted to ask you, I mean, your earlier films seem to me to be very concerned with apocalyptic imagery or figures. I think of The Survivalists in Sherman's March. I think of The Jehovah's Witness in Time Indefinite.
Right.
You know, in photographic memory, I mean, the apocalyptic there seems to be more personal. You know, or if it's there at all, maybe it's subdued. To what degree do you think that at this stage of the game, you are still informed by lingering anxieties about the end?
Well, you know, I think it's like all of us. I think about it all the time. If you think about Iran and its nuclear weapons, terrorism, you know, right down the street.
Yeah.
And it's it never goes away. I think it's impossible to command myself to include that theme in every one of my documentaries. There's just not room. You can only stuff in so many themes per film.
Yeah.
And it's not really in Bright Leaves either, as you know, the apocalypse, the end of the world. It's in some films. It's not in all the films. You know, Bright Leaves, the tobacco film, has the kind of industry-induced apocalypse of tobacco and what the harmful effects of smoking are worldwide. So it's there, maybe a slightly different shape. It's really not there in photographic memory, and it's not as if I was struggling to find a way for it to be in there. Some sense of apocalypse or the end. I think there's a personal contemplation of the end of one's own life implied in my film because, again, looking back over 38 years, which just evaporated, you do have to confront your own mortality in a situation, especially when you go back to a place that you haven't been to in so long and try to remember what you were doing at that age. And then you think, what happened all that time? And, you know, there's a whole generation of us, and there'll always be, every generation is going to experience this, but not every generation, not everyone in every generation takes the trouble to go back and try to piece together the puzzle of what happened at a particular time in one's life. I try to do that in photographic memory, using photographs that I have, because there's no footage. I wasn't a filmmaker back then.
Yeah.
And my memory.
Going back to Adrian, the sharp contrast between who Adrian is in your previous films and who he is now. I mean, in Bright Leaves, you're filming this woman, and he's actually doing the sound while you're going ahead and talking with her.
That's right.
And there's, of course, the fishing and so forth. And then in photographic memory, it's like it almost seems as if there's no trace of that kid at all. I mean, he is the same, but there's just such a transformation. And I'm wondering, what do you think accounts for that transformation? And does this film truly, I guess, reveal Adrian in a way that's accurate, in a way that I'm sort of implying based off of my takeaway on the film?
Well, I have to ask you a question.
Yes.
Do you have kids?
I don't.
Uh-huh. I think the world divides.
Yeah.
And there are people who come up to me, teenagers, and say, my God, you got it on film. How'd you do that? This is what's so maddening about having teenagers. You love them so much. And
yeah.
You know, they are just determined to force you back, to push you back. And of course, again, I'm not an idiot. I understand you got to give a kid room to develop the directions that they want to go in. And my father was actually very good about that with me. He questioned and challenged me to be sure that I knew what I was doing enough that I could support myself and that I would be happy and fulfilled in my life. And that's really all I wanted for Adrian. And yet, you know, I sort of heightened the drama and the tension between us by choosing moments where we're really batting our heads together. But I think people who have children who see this understand and see something very familiar to them. And people who don't have kids yet will think, oh, this is what's coming, or was I really like that when I was that age? They see it differently. So the audiences maybe break down that way and have different reactions as to whether what I've presented or what I've captured of Adrian and shown in the film is truthful or not, or real.
Yeah.
And so...
So in terms of the transformation, the explanation, you say, doesn't matter? Or
Well, I think, you know, that's what often happens with kids. They're delightful when they're 4, 5, 6. You love them to death. You can't believe that these little creatures exist and that they've been sent to you and how wonderful that is. And then something happens when they hit puberty. They become, you know, much more difficult, much more complicated, and kind of hard to be with.
Yeah.
But that's a very common phenomenon, I think.
In terms of the memories in this film, my partner watched Photographic Memory with me, and this is sort of a concern she had that quickly infested me, too. You are going and trying to track down Maude.
Right.
A woman who you lived with, a woman who you were with, and you don't remember her last name. And I have to say that this, the fact that you don't recall her last name, the fact that your copious journals don't actually feature the last name, led my partner and I to sort of discuss at length whether, you know, because then we went ahead and rattled off the names of all of our roommates, first name and last name, and we were sort of, you know, he probably should remember the last name of a very seductive lover in France. So what of this? I mean, this part of the game of what you're not telling us?
Oh, no, I actually did not remember her last name, nor
really?
The last name of my employer. It seems amazing to me now. As I say in the film, I never wrote those things down. What was wrong with me? And that, you know, actually, don't say this in the film, but my son, you know, some of the things he doesn't do, why am I so upset about that? I didn't do it myself. You know, just noting down facts that could be important to you.
Yeah.
But no, and also the other difference is 38 years is a lot different. I mean, I'm older than you.
Yeah, of course.
You know, all that time goes by. You're going to remember all the people you knew, you know, 38 years ago?
Maybe
Do you write them all down? Data was it's much more easier to record now.
Well, Ross, if you have an absolutely stunning French paramour, I would think that you would remember her last name, even if it was 38 years. That's why, you know.
Yeah, it's a good
unless
question.
It was just a haze you don't want to deal with.
No,
unless there was some sort of philandering phase, in which case all the strings of ladies kind of, you know, come into a blur. Okay, sure.
Thank you. It's our studio producer here.
Yeah.
5 minutes. It's a good question. It seems unbelievable to me. I mean, my producer wanted to know, you mean you didn't write her name down? Because we were trying to find out if she was still there, doing internet and Google research, and there's nobody. I couldn't find her. Maude, you know, there are a million Maudes in France. There's no way to track her down. And the same for Maurice. There are a million Maurices. I don't know why I didn't write their names down. I was just being spacey. I just living my life as a sort of driving a battered Volkswagen around France like thousands of other kids were doing. And I did not know her last name.
Yeah.
So that's to tell your partner that, no, I'm not withholding information.
The consummate documentarian did not actually log his escapades.
Well, he wasn't a documentarian then. Maybe that's the reason why. And
it's
as I say, I think I was really set on writing fiction back then. So, you know, I never... There was never, you know, I probably did have it written down. I probably had it on some piece of paper or something. I lost it a long time ago.
So these early journals are more committed to fiction than actually logging your adventures?
Yeah. Oh, no, they're totally fictionalized. I mean, now and then I would make a reference to something I'd seen.
Yeah.
But only because I thought it might be useful to convert into fiction.
Yeah. Then why didn't you actually pursue fiction, and not in a Hollywood manner, but in some kind of manner?
Well,
on
I did.
Film.
You know,
yeah.
I tried becoming a writer.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote fiction for a long time, and just
did
can never
did you publish any stories.
Or? No, I never could get it. I mean, you read the one thing I published, which is an essay, but it's nonfiction.
Yeah.
It's not the only thing I published, but
yeah.
No, I mean, I just discovered it was too isolating for me. I hated sort of staying behind a desk and just working by myself. And the great thing about filmmaking is to get you out in the world. Often, you know, if you're working with people, then you're working with multiple people making something. That was all very appealing to me, as distinct from the solitude required to do good writing.
How many stories did you try writing back?
Countless. You know, I had novel ideas. I mean, in the journal pages,
yeah.
still frame it, you can see the fictional names of some of the characters.
Yeah.
You know, Will, W-I-L. Will was one of my alter egos, fictionalized.
So. Oh, you're Henry Miller.
I have these complex schemes that make no sense to me now, but you know that there was version A, version B, and then version A1, A2, A3. I mean, it was so complex, and that way I'm a little bit like my son. I think I got lost in this mesh of fictional possibilities of ways in which narrative could go. And when Cinema Verite, you know, handheld documentary filmmaking came along, I think it really saved me in a way. It gave me a situation where get this on film, and that's what you have to deal with. You have to make a story from these 30 hours of footage.
Yeah.
You can't go back and film more. You can't change the footage you've already gotten. It has to come from this. And that saved me. That was this wonderful decision-making process that was foisted on me. I then had to deal with what I had. Whereas in fiction, you can always change something. You just keep extrapolating forever and never get to where you're going.
So this is fascinating. So you need to have a maximum limit in order to create something.
I think with this, I did. That was the thing I liked about having to go to France on the budget I had under the auspices of Arte. This is the French TV channel that I had to get in 30 days. And I had to come back and I had to edit it. And it had to be done in 1 year. It had to be, you know, premiered in Venice. It had to be done by then. And that kind of restriction actually helped me, I think.
So then with video, you could pretty much shoot almost anything. I mean, how do you deal with that, especially since you are really working with video here the first time? I mean, you know, if you can go ahead and film every conceivable angle, you could literally be at the camera and not walk away from it. I mean, how does this affect your ability to be selective or to be limited, create something?
I think because I was trained on film, and film is very expensive, and you can only shoot 10 minutes at a time, then you have to change magazines, and it's like $200 every time you shoot a roll and get it processed and work printed. You know, that was a tremendous discipline that was foisted on me when I was young. And it meant that I didn't have unlimited footage, and that I had to make it work with a certain amount of footage. So that training stays with me. But, you know, the way that digital video has changed me a bit, I think, is that I'm now willing to hold a shot a little bit longer than I used to be able to in case something happens. But, you know, the trick is not to let that spill over and expand your shooting so much that then you come back and you're swamped in the editing room. And a lot of people shoot like, you know, 500-600 hours in order to get a 1 hour film. I mean, I can't imagine doing that.
Well, you see this as a teacher. Your students come in and they don't have that set of limitations.
Well, my students are neophytes. They come in, they're undergrads.
Yes.
So they don't have much experience anyway. But I think for graduate students, that's a real danger.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was going to ask, I mean, how is this going to affect people's ability to be selective, to choose the right moments from reality that really are meaningful, that strike a chord to audiences? How do you think this is going to work itself out?
I'm not sure. I don't think I can answer that. I can say that I think what it's leading to are bigger post-production teams where you actually hire people who go through the footage and you trust them based upon something. And you say, okay, you're going to look at this 28 hours of film.
Yeah.
Knowing what the film's about, I want you to select, you know, 17 moments that you think are really, really good. Then you give another 28 hours to somebody else. They do the same thing. And then third, fourth. That's how you get through all the footage. And then someone, you know, some sort of uber filmmaker, director, person has to then go through what they've already gone through. And the same thing is true for film festivals selecting films. Yeah. I mean, there's just too many out there right now. How do they select? Well, they hire people to go through them and say, you know, under these criteria, select, you know, 10% of the films you look at and forward them to us, and then we'll... I mean, it's like a digital nightmare.
You know, it occurs to me that some of the economic cutbacks might actually be a blessing to solve this problem, because if everybody's shooting film and you can only hire so many people, this actually solves the problem, at least right now. But if we get into flush times, it's a different story.
Yeah.
Speaking of limitations, I know you have to go, but Ross, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat.
Thank you so much. Right. Really great.
Okay.
Nose slack curved. We spent